It's time for security now. Steve Gibson is here, and we're going to talk about what he says is the most sophisticated malware ever written. Flame. It's next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 355, recorded May 30th, 2012, poking holes in TCP. It's time for Security Now, time to protect yourself, batten down the security hatches, if you will, with this man right here, our explainer-in-chief, Mr. Steve Gibson of GRC.com, and a good day to you, Steve.
Hey, Leo, great to be back with you again, as always. And speaking of battening down the hatches,
yes,
we've got two big stories in our news is the details which are known so far, and they're still a little scant, but because this has just happened, and that is the most sophisticated piece of malware or malware system ever found.
Whoa.
Was recently uncovered by Kaspersky. When they were looking for something else, they stumbled over this thing.
That's how penicillin was found. Post-it notes. So it's a long-standing tradition.
Not quite the glue we were looking for, but we think we could use this.
So what makes it so sophisticated? Now, remember, Stuxnet, and I presume Duco, were written by governments, right?
Well, and what makes this so sophisticated is the complexity and the power of it. It uses heretofore unknown injection techniques. I mean, basically, it has a ton of new technology, which has never been seen before. It is believed that this has to have been generated by a nation state. It may be more than 5 years old. Pieces Ooh. Of it have turned up. Now that they know what they're looking for, they can go back and realize that VirusTotal was seeing some instances of this, and it renames itself at one point, and those names have been picked up in archives from 2007. So, and whereas Stuxnet and Dooku, well, Stuxnet specifically, was extremely focused on, as we now know, on upsetting the centrifuges of Iran's nuclear enrichment program, this is a comprehensive, general-purpose, high-power espionage tool. Now, what we don't yet know is how widespread it is. Apparently, it is all over the Middle East, sort of anecdotally, that much we have. But anyway, we're going to talk about that. And then also, what I mentioned we would talk about last week is the main topic, and that is, I titled this Poking Holes in TCP. This came to my attention from a bunch of people who were tweeting it to me when it was in the news. And this was two researchers at University of Michigan have found some new ways of injecting malicious code or malicious content, to make it more generic, because it is malicious content into TCP connections without needing a man in the middle presence. So they can be standing to the side, essentially, and interfere with TCP. So this is that of course caught my attention. Now the good news is it's more limited than the title and the synopsis makes it sound. So it's less of a concern, but it's a perfect topic for us on a technical podcast like this, because it gives us a chance to look more closely at TCP, which is the Internet's, you know, most used protocol. More data moves across TCP than you know, everything else summed up. Maybe streaming now with video and audio over UDP. Offsets that. But, you know, all of our web pages, you know, all of the connection-oriented traffic is TCP-based. And we've talked about in podcasts past the way TCP works. We'll look at it a little more closely relative to the glitch that these guys have found, which is, you know, interesting and provides some lessons for us. So I think a great podcast today.
Oh, very.
And then a little bit of random miscellaneous news.
And all of that, thanks to Mr. Steve Gibson. Let's kick it. We don't have a commercial, so just go, baby, go.
Let's get into Flamer.
Flame. I don't know if I like Flamer quite so much.
It's been called Flamer. It's been called Flame. And, in fact, a Hegarian research group, who I'll be talking about, Crisis, they named it before they realized what it was internally named. They named it Skywiper. So various people were tweeting to me about Skywiper as if it was something new, but it's the same as this super sophisticated malware that blows everything else that we've seen before away. Kaspersky was interviewed. They were the people who first discovered this, having been asked by, I think it was the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union, to look into this. That they were looking for something which was wiping the drives of machines throughout the Middle East. And so in looking at those machines, they found something else that was before this unknown to them, and that caught their attention. The guys at Kaspersky are calling it the most sophisticated malware ever found, dwarfing Stuxnet and Dooku. It is 20 meg of code in total for the whole thing. And get this, Leo, it bundles SQLite as its database back in.
Oh, in it? So when you install it, you get SQLite?
You get an instance of SQLite running in your system because I'll go through the means of data gathering.
They need a database?
It builds a comprehensive structured database of everything it collects.
Wow.
As on its
No wonder it's 20 megs. Holy cow.
Yeah, it's like a little OS that has just set up residence inside of your main operating system.
Jeez.
So here we have 20 meg, whereas Stuxnet was only a couple hundred K. So, you know, it's 10 times the size of Stuxnet. One of the reasons being that, as we saw, it has a complete database architecture. So now Iran got into it, and their equivalent of CERT, their internet security agency that's called MAHER, M-A-H-E-R, they have a posting that I'll quote from. They said, having conducted multiple, and one reason is, you know, it's apparently rampant within Iran. So having conducted multiple investigations during the last few months, the MAHER Center, the Iranian CERT, CC, following the continuous research on the targeted attacks of Stuxnet and Dooku since 2010, announces the latest detection of a new attack for the very first time. The attack, codenamed Flame, due to some names contained within the reverse engineered code, is launched. The attack, codenamed Flame, is launched by a new malware. The name Flame comes from one of the attack modules located at various places in the decrypted malware code. In fact, this malware is a platform which is capable of receiving and installing various modules for different goals. At the time of writing, none of the 43 tested antiviruses could detect any of the malicious components. Nevertheless, a detector was created by MAHER Center and delivered to selected organizations and companies in the first days of May. And now a removal tool is ready to be delivered. Okay, so some features of the malware. It can be distributed. I should comment that understand this is compiled code. There's no source for it. They're dealing with 20 megs, and I mean that itself makes the task of reverse engineering this behemoth very daunting, because you know they've got to watch it operate in you know, in a controlled mode with their own spy tools running. And these are the people at Crisis and Kaspersky and the various organizations that have received this are now to, I mean, like right now, as we're recording this, they're working together, sharing their information and working to understand it. But this task of understanding it is a matter of both watching it to see what it does, and, you know, like watch it hook things, watch it inject code into different modules, run rootkit checkers against it to see which low-level kernel hooks it has grabbed in order to hide itself. I mean, there's the behavioral side. Then they also have to reverse engineer this. They have to decompile, you know, disassemble this code, and then figure out what's in there that whose behavior they haven't seen. So we'll be, you know, I imagine this will be peeling layers off of a very large onion for some time to come, and we'll be touching back on this as we learn more. So we do know that it can be distributed via removable networks and local area networks. It's capable of sniffing the network, detecting network resources, and collecting lists of vulnerable passwords as they pass by in the clear. It can scan disks of the infected system, looking for specific file extensions and contents. It is able to perform screen captures of the infected machine when specific processes or windows are active. It's able to capture the contents of any fields filled out, even when obscured by asterisks or dots so that they're password fields. It can turn on the system's attached microphone and record over a long period of time any sounds in the environment. All of this data is saved in an SQL-like database, which is then able to transfer en masse to control servers. There are more than 10 domains that have been identified as the command and control, the CNC servers. It establishes secure encrypted connections with those servers through SSH and HTTPS protocols. So it's encrypting its traffic as well, point to point. It bypasses all known antivirus detection, anti-malware, and other security software. It's able to infect XP.
Well, wait a minute. How could it do that? I mean,
well, first of all, it wasn't known. So none of these things knew to look for.
But now that they know, won't they find it?
Absolutely. But what it was doing also is it uses 5 different encryption technologies and 3 different compression technologies.
See, that's scary. If a virus can bypass antivirus detection, that would be a scary technology to have available.
Well, and remember that many of these new AVs have a problem with false positives.
Right.
Because they are looking for things, not behavior and not specific known signatures, but they're looking for suspicious code. And for example, you know, every maybe half a year or so, someone will report that some random update of an AV package, it now thinks that one of my exes, one of GRC's freeware, is suddenly, you know, viral. And it's like, no, it's not.
It's usually pretty crappy stuff that does
well,
that.
But this is, you know, it's difficult to do because you'd like to catch things you don't know about, but you don't want a false positive. So what's significant is that even behavioral analysis didn't catch this. Apparently for 5 years, nothing saw this hooking DLLs. For example, Stuxnet and Dooku have relatively straightforward code injection technology. This is completely new. This is using technology that we've never seen before. So nothing knew how to look for it. It can infect XP, Vista, and Windows 7. And it's apparently expert at infecting large-scale local networks. Quoting from one of the reports, they said, according to file naming conventions, propagation methods, complexity level, precise targeting, and superb functionality, it seems that there is a this is still from Iran. It seems that there is a close relation to the Stuxnet and Dooku targeted attacks. Now, that actually turns out not to be the case. Kaspersky and Crisis, who have looked at this independently, both think this is there's no connection. It was whatever this is, it was created by a different organization or group than Stuxnet and Dooku. Whereas those were targeted for specific purposes, this is a hugely comprehensive general purpose espionage tool which has been out there doing its job in secret maybe for 5 years. So they
5 years. Well, maybe it does.
Yeah.
Maybe it does get around antivirus. Holy cow!
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's what has shocked people is they have found the.
But if it's a spear phishing attack that's going after Iranian government installations, it might not be detected because it's just not out in the wild, or is it?
Well, for example, let me scroll down to my notes. One of the files. The core file, which is downloaded by the initial loader, is called MSSecManager, MSSECMGR.OCX. So that's an ActiveX control of Windows. It renames itself, or rather that file is renamed by the installation component to WaveSup3, SUP3.DRV. That file has been observed, was observed in Europe on December 5th of 2007, so 5 years ago nearly, in the UAE on April 28th in 2008, and in the and Iran for the first time on March 1st of 2010. So, and it did not raise alarm. It didn't trip any alarm. No behavior was seen.
Please.
I know. it sounds like science fiction that we're talking about, and it's as real as any of these malware threats that we've seen recently. So they said, the research on these samples implies that the recent incidents of mass data loss in Iran could be the outcome of some installed module of this threat. Now, again, that's at this point hypothetical. A list of the major infection components of this malware is presented below. These samples would be available for security software vendors. And they list some, but that's no longer unique. Then the Crisis guys, who are in Hungary, they're the Laboratory of Cryptography and System Security. They're maintaining a paper that is tracking this. They're at crisis.hu, and their paper is crysus.hu/skywiper/skywiper.pdf. And that was just the name they assigned it randomly before they realized there was a name embedded in the code. So they have a technical report that they've put together, noting that there's been deliberate obfuscation of dates. For example, the exes themselves have dates set back to 97, for whatever reason, to make them look like they're not new. But tearing these things apart, they have found instances of that are much newer. For example, this has the version of SQLite, which is installed inside, is version 3.6.22 from January 5th of 2010. So, this is in fact much newer, although the date stamps are deliberately set back to make it look older. So Crisis, in their report, says that they have found evidence of 5 different encryption methods, and I happen to note one of them is as simple as XORing with FF. So that just flips, it just inverts all the bits of the byte. So that's very fast, and it's simple.
Yeah, it's effective. Unless you're looking for it. It's easy to decrypt, right? But only if you're looking for it.
Right. But there is, for example, also RC4 encryption, which is strong when it's applied correctly. It was encrypting WEP protocol originally, and in fact still encrypts TKIP when it's being used, because there's nothing wrong with it when you use it correctly. So 5 different methods of encryption, 3 different methods of compression, 5 different known file formats, plus some proprietary formats. And for example, the SQLite database is one of the well-known formats, which it just uses unmodified. It uses, as I mentioned before, completely new, previously unknown code injection technology. It locally stores information that which it gathers in this in a highly structured SQLite database. Get this, Leo. It uses the Lua scripting language.
Oh, yeah. Excellent choice. Lua, I actually studied Lua. It's a really nice scripting language. You know what's written in Lua is, well, a lot of games use Lua. Yeah, exactly. For a command kind of code. And then Lightroom, Adobe Lightroom is written in Lua. It's a scripting language. It's a good glue language.
That's true. It's a nice language. It's also free. So it's nice
it's
to
open.
Know
yeah.
that these people were not pirating.
Open source. Yeah. You know, Wordsworth had an interesting hypothesis in the chat room. He says, it sounds like it was engineered in small modules deployed independently to see whether they could be detected prior to being integrated into a larger malware package. Is that the feeling you're
feasible.
Getting? It's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly feasible. It apparently, like all of these late model malware, there's a component that installs itself and hides itself and arranges to run. So that you've got to have that.
A little stub program. It's not very big,
yes.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Exactly. And then it knows how to go check in with headquarters. You know, then we've seen various types of command and control. The most recent ones are those where it uses the time and date and a cryptographic algorithm to dynamically generate domain names on the fly. So they're not built into it. You can't just, like, look at a list of domain names. But at a certain time and date, it dynamically generates a domain name, and the bad guys have pre-registered that domain and arranged DNS so that it's able to look up, you know, where they now are. So, I mean, this has gotten very sophisticated. And unfortunately, the net provides, you know, this kind of power. It's the benefit of the internet, but also, you know, a substantial liability.
This is the weak point, the weak link, I guess, in these viruses is they need to contact a server for command and control. And that, you know, knowing that information lets you block the server. So they're being very clever about delaying the activation of that server and obscuring. But as soon as they connect, isn't it obvious? I mean, don't we then know, we got them? Because they have to make an explicit connection.
There are also, sometimes they use Tor, sometimes they bounce through relays a few times. But yes, your point is it's very much the same way that our domestic FBI follow the money. Because, you know, the bad guys who are extorting have to somehow get paid. That's their weak link. And so, you know, it's possible similarly to track that and catch them, which is often what happens. So information gathering by this master espionage program are keystrokes on the keyboard, screen captures, which are grabbed and compressed and then stuck into the SQL database, the microphone, so audio being recorded, contents of the drive, and not just all of it, but specific searches and requests are fulfilled. It's sniffing the network and collecting data from the network. It knows about Wi-Fi and is able to exploit that when available. It knows about Bluetooth, and if Bluetooth radio is on, it will sit there and monitor Bluetooth channel and USB and system processes. And it contains rootkit injection and hiding techniques, also new, never seen before. So Crisis said, the results of our technical analysis support the hypothesis that SkyWiper, which is their name for the same thing, was developed by a government agency of a nation state with significant budget and effort.
Jeez.
And it may be related to cyber warfare activities. Yeah,
mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm,
you think?
Mm-hmm,
uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
SkyWiper is certainly the most sophisticated malware we encountered during our practice. Arguably, it is the most complex malware ever found. And finally, as I mentioned before, It looks like it's been around for at least 5 years, you know, doing something, doing its thing. And part of the modular nature of this is the fact that once you get that kernel installed and propagated, you are able to evolve this over time. So today's Flame, or as Crisis calls it, Skywiper, may not be what was there 5 years ago. These capabilities can be added over time, and these things are able to evolve. So as I mentioned, it's been found around the globe for many years. The whole package is 20 meg. This one key, that MSSECMGR.OCX file, is generally around a meg, but there have been different versions of it each time that it's been seen, sometimes a little larger than a megabyte, sometimes a little smaller than a megabyte. And Crisis said since they were heavily involved in the discovery and analysis of Dooku, their preliminary analysis suggests that Skywiper was not, they said in bold caps, made by the same development team as Stuxnet and Dooku.
Interesting. Wow.
Really, really.
There's a novel in here. There's a nonfiction. I would love to see somebody like John Markoff really dig his teeth into this and figure out what happened and the whole story. Because, boy, that would be a fascinating book. Fascinating.
It's interesting, too, how with the archives of the past that we're now beginning to accumulate, just because we've got virtually limitless hard drive storage, that it is possible to turn back the clock and you know, find things that once existed.
Right.
You know, so it's possible to, you know, to look at the state of the Internet 5 years ago.
Internet archaeology.
Yeah. And you know, and do, you know, do true analysis, you know, like not only reverse engineering of this, but reverse engineering of its history before it was known to exist. So it really can be done. So anyway, I will certainly be looking for people who tweet any new findings about this, and I'll track them down and figure out what they mean and report to people.
Fascinating.
Speaking of tweeting, I got a couple interesting little bits from the Twitterverse. A couple tweets from people who do work at ISPs who have been working to remediate DNS changer troubles. We talked about this a week or two ago, where the, you know, and you remember you had strong feelings about the FBI having volunteered and given control over to the ISC.
FBI in the middle attack, I call it.
Yes. So, you know, I think there was a little bit of stubbed toes from ISPs feeling like, well, we were saying they weren't doing anything. It turns out it's just a difficult thing to do. So they're, you know, they are working to detect when their users have computers that are checking with these malicious DNS servers and somehow trying to notify them of that fact. So that was good to know. And I mentioned an alternative to permit cookies, a Firefox extension I have loved for years and used until it seemed for me to stop working. But Todd Eddy, E-D-D-Y, in Ohio, sent me a tweet noting that he is maintaining the abandoned Firefox permit cookies add-on, but only to repair critical bugs, and he continually updates the version compatibility tag. I don't know what the problem was. I did try to update mine to this one that he's maintaining, I think under Firefox 12, but it might have been 11. But it, you know, it no longer functioned, and so I abandoned it for that push button cookie gizmo that basically replaces it that I told our listeners about last week.
Yeah.
And finally, I got a note from someone who's written before, Christian Alexandrov, who apparently suffered a 5.8 magnitude earthquake in Bulgaria, and many hard drives were damaged, not surprisingly, by that. He said, "Hello, Steve. I want to share a SpinRite story." He said, "Oh, the subject goes, when earthquake strikes, SpinRite strikes back." He said, "I want to share a SpinRite story with Security Now listeners. Recently, a few days ago, earthquake struck our country. Earthquake's magnitude was 5.8. That's a big earthquake, Leo.
Yeah. I mean, well, I mean,
yeah, okay.
Big for Bulgaria. I mean, here in California, well, that's just a little Tembler.
Yeah, we just have our overpasses rocking a little bit.
No, it's a big earthquake. It's big.
Yeah.
Bulgaria is in seismological calm area, and such.
That's why it's a big deal. See, because it's unfamiliar to them. They're not prepared.
Such earthquakes are rare. The last earthquake equal to this one was 167 years ago.
Whoa.
Yeah, I wonder how they know that, because did we have the Richter scale?
167? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh. Well, something like it.
Yeah. The earthquake created a lot of work for me and for Spinrite. I go all over Sofia City to help to revive hard disks that suffered damage caused by the earthquake. So clearly, pedestal-based PCs fell over while they were spinning.
Wow.
And that's not good for the hard drive.
That actually is quite a bit of shaking if your PC fell over.
Yeah.
Jeez.
And so he said, within that entire range, I maintain only four PCs were not damaged at all, regardless of the fact the PCs were working during the earthquake. And then I'm going to skip this paragraph where he talks about the four that weren't damaged. Mm-hmm. He says, however, on many places, I had to go with Spinrite as my tool of choice. A lot of hard drives were damaged. Spinrite gave a lot of drives that special care they needed to make them good for work again. Some people called me to try and fix their hard drives before they asked for help from PC repair services, or sometimes they called me after. Get this. Of all the range of PCs I maintain, I was the only one who used Spinrite and brought over 180 damaged hard drives back to life. And it was a wide variety of hard drives from 20 gigabyte UATA-33 to 1 terabyte SATA-3 drives that were saved and brought back to life by Spinrite. Needless to say, there were a lot of U and R red squares on all drives on the first level 4 scan and a lot of B icons on second level 4 scan, where the U and R icons were before. And also, needless to say, what large number of files were saved, and a large number of systems now work fine. Suddenly, I become a PC hero for saving PCs and bringing hard disks back to life, and saving files and OSs. Work here is still in progress, many drives still to fix, and many are taken care of by Spinrite. I do somewhere between 10 and 15 drives at a time, and many computers have two or three physical hard drives in them. Steve, once again, thank you for your great piece of software, and once again, thank you, Steve and Leo, for the great Security Now podcast. I wish best of luck to both GRC.com and Twit.tv, a happy Spinrite user.
Wow. So, well, there you go. Now you have a new slogan. Built for earthquake country. Jeez.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Cool. That is really interesting. Let us continue on poking holes in TCP, shall we?
Speaking of poking holes in TCP.
Yes.
Some researchers, two security researchers in Michigan. I have to warn everybody. If you did not have your propeller cap on
this time,
maybe this is a good spot to pause and go, refresh your coffee or open a new can of. I hope you're not opening a can of soda because that's not good for you.
No, sardines.
There you go. A can of sardines.
Go get a can of sardines.
Okay, because this is going to get a little hairy, but it's good hairy. It's important hairy and perfect. Perfect topic for, this podcast that pushes the limits of what we're able to do over an audio channel. We're going to do that today. So a couple researchers were looking at the security of primarily cellular networks. That is, their platform focused was Android and Android connected to the internet via cellular was the scenario they set up. What we'll talk about is broader than that, really, but they've only focused on that. And it's broader because it's really about the Transmission Control Protocol, TCP, which is the basis for the web and all kinds of apps which are now using TCP behind the scenes. They may not look like a web browser, but they're actually setting up persistent connections back to a server in order to communicate. For example, when I have TweetDeck up, it's got TCP connections open through which it's using the Twitter API to communicate. So what they discovered was that there were what they called middleware firewalls installed in these mobile networks. They detected them. I think they checked 147 mobile networks, and they found them in 31% of them, so about one-third of them. The firewalls were there to block unwanted traffic, just like a firewall sort of in the middle of their network and said, okay, you know, at this point, anything going in either direction that looks funky, let's get rid of it. Well, these are stateful firewalls which know which connections have been made through them. And that way, they're very much like our NAT routers that we've talked about, that are stateful routers where incoming packets are just dropped because they don't correspond to a connection that was initiated from the inside out, which is what allows connections to come back or packets of connections to come back in. So these are firewalls which, when a SYN packet, a synchronized TCP synchronized packet, encounters a firewall on its way to a destination on the other side of the firewall makes note of it. It looks at the source IP and port, at the destination IP and port, and adds that to its, okay, a connection is being set up through me table. Then when the answering SYN ACK comes back to the firewall, it makes sure that SYN ACK is expected. And if so, it updates its tables and passes the SYN ACK on towards its destination. So it's sort of a blockade just sitting at an arbitrary middle point in a cellular provider's network, because if SYN packets are just, you know, like a from a denial of service attack, if a SYN packet hits it that it isn't expecting, or an ACK packet or something, you know, bogus in one way or another, it just ignores it. Well, one of the things that these firewalls do is they validate the traffic on an ongoing basis. They watch the setup, and people who have followed along with our talk about how TCP works will remember that the reason we call a SYN packet, S-Y-N, a SYN, is SYN is short for synchronize, and this is the connection initiator saying, I'm going to number my packets starting at this number. And there's a sequence, a 32-bit sequence counter in all TCP packets, which numbers the first byte of the payload in that packet. So, for example, if a sender were to send out packets of 1,000 bytes, then successive packets would contain these sequence numbers that were 1,000 larger each time. Well, that's done because, as we well know, packets don't always arrive in order at the other end. The route that packets take is not predetermined by either the sender or the receiver. Those are determined just by routing tables among all the routers that link these two points. So it's possible that one router could be busy, and an interface might be backed up, so it routes the packet somewhere else, so a later packet could get to its destination sooner. So it's necessary to number the bytes in the packet so that they can be reassembled in the proper sequence when they arrive. So TCP has been a target of attack in the past, and the sequence numbers are one of the weaknesses of TCP. So if we were to step back for a minute and come up with a lesson that we're about to learn, it is that if you have a fundamentally unsecure protocol, there isn't a way to add security later. It was an argument that I made against Backblaze, where they sort of tried to add a user password in a hokey way to give people a greater sense of security, but it actually achieved nothing in terms of true security for the user, or it achieved very little. That is, they had a broken model where they were doing the decryption at their server end, and that couldn't change, no matter what they added on top of it. In the case of TCP, it was designed, as we know, literally decades ago, back when numbering packets with a 32-bit count seemed like more than enough. It was that, you know, 32 bits gives us 4 billion. And there's nothing wrong with these counters wrapping, that is, counting up to 4 billion and then wrapping around back to zero. They do that all the time. TCP understands that if it has a high packet number and then suddenly it's got one very near zero, that it didn't go back 4 billion, it just went ahead a few. So it allows and handles gracefully that wraparound from the maximum back to the minimum, as all the binary bits, all 32 binary bits, fill up with ones and then click back over to zero again. So the designers thought, well, 4 billion. Now, the reason we have sequence numbers is several. One is, as I mentioned, we want to number the bytes that we're sending in each direction. So a TCP packet has a sequence number for its data that it's carrying, and it also has a sequence number which acknowledges the most recently in order, received in order, packet that it has received. So what normally is happening is, after the SYN goes and then the SYNACK comes back, a final ACK is sent, an acknowledgement acknowledging the SYN of the SYNACK packet. From then on, all the packets going back and forth have their ACK bits set, each end acknowledging what they've received so far from the other end. So the system works nicely. 32 bits to number the data. So that's plenty. It means that if packets come in out of sequence, it's obvious how they should be arranged. The other purpose for this, though, is because packets wander around the internet, we know that they're clipped off by their TTL field, the time to live, which is decremented by every router which forwards the packet. And any router which decrements it to zero will send back an expired notice to the sender of the packet saying, well, I tried to send this, I wanted to, but TTL went to zero, and if we didn't honor that, the internet absolutely would crash, because packets would never die. They just roam around forever and fill up the internet. So the fact that they die is crucial. But it still means that if you have a very high bandwidth connection and a long delay between endpoints, it's difficult to see how you could have 4 billion bytes in flight at any time. And the designers were very comfortable with the idea that 32 bits would never wrap around within the lifetime of a single packet on the net. And that's the key, is that because connections, TCP connections, come up and down and up and down, they're often very short-lived connections. They establish, send something, and then drop again. And then the connection may be reinitiated. Now, the problem between the same two endpoints, connections are identified by the source IP and port and destination IP and port. And so if you brought the connection up, sent some traffic, took it apart, and then brought it back up again and made another connection, what you wanted, what the designers of TCP wanted to guarantee against was the possibility that lost packets wandering around from the previous session, the previous connection, might be confused with packets from this session. So the way they solve that problem is by advancing the sequence numbers forward for actually for the whole system. They normally they do it system wide so that any connection that is it is created uses forward moving sequence numbers so that all of the numbered traffic that is leaving it will never have the same numbers as older traffic. And that's a little confusing because you would think that we're always counting from zero. The idea is that that SYN packet, the sequence packet, says we're going to count from this number. So this number equals zero and 1,000 plus this number equals 1,000. So the idea being that these sequence numbers move forward and in what was once a uniform fashion. Well, the hackers figured out that they could take advantage of older operating systems' uniform sequencing. That is, the idea was they figured out that by talking to a server, for example, a router, they could determine the router's current sequence number. And because they would get some, they would initiate a connection to it. It would send back its SYN ACK that would tell them the current state of the sequence number. Then what these clever hackers did was they were able to spoof TCP traffic because they were able to guess what other connections that either later existed or pre-existed. They could guess the probable sequence numbers of those connections. So this was a huge problem for the internet, and it resulted in the randomization of TCP sequence, these initial sequence numbers, the ISNs, for communications. So for a while, there was a problem because the hackers figured out how to get the sequence numbers of probable connections. The response was to randomize those. And in fact, what Linux does is being 32 bits, that's 4 bytes. Linux takes the most significant byte and increments it every 5 minutes. And then for the lower 24 bits, they just use a random number. So it's jumping all around within 1/256 of the total sequence number space, and that's moving forward, jumping forward every 5 minutes. So that's still believed to be about the best trade-off you can come up with for between random and still meeting some of the goals of moving sequence numbers generally forward over time so that you don't have various types of replay attacks. So what these guys in Michigan figured out is a new way of determining a connection's packet sequence numbering. And that's bad because when you think about it, there isn't any protection in TCP. I mean, there really isn't. It's only obscurity which protects TCP. It's the fact that unless you can see the traffic going back and forth, you don't know for sure what the originating port was. You may know what the destination port. If it's a server, for example, HTTP, it's going to be port 80. If it's going to be SSL, it's port 443. If it's POP, it's port 110, and so forth. You know, SMTP, port 25. We know those so-called well-known ports at the server end. We also know the server's IP, and we may know the originator's IP. So now we have just the question of what port it generated its traffic from. And unfortunately, most OSs still do that in a uniform from the bottom up fashion. They just issue traffic sequentially. So if you can get that client to talk to you, you know what its current outbound port enumeration is. And so that gives you lots of information from which you can spoof TCP traffic. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about a new way to insert traffic into TCP sessions that gets around this problem that the initial sequence numbers are now being randomized by all contemporary operating systems. So what these guys do is they have a number of approaches that they take. I'll describe one in more detail because it's representative and it'll give you a sense for this. Their main exploit is not completely standing off to the side and attacking. It is possible to do that, and they outline how that can be done. I explained how you can know what their IP is, what their source port is, you know what the destination port and the destination IP is. And so there are completely like third-party attacks, which they have identified and verified. But the one that works best is one which is also really interesting because it demonstrates an interesting failure in sandboxing. They implemented this with Android-based phones from HTC, Samsung, and Motorola using Android version 2.2 and 2.3.4 from those manufacturers. And they installed an unprivileged piece of software. We'll call it malware because it's not doing what you want it to do. It may be offering some service to you, but it's also doing more than that. But this malware is unprivileged, meaning your phone does not need to be jailbroken. It's not even breaking out of the sandbox because they discovered some very clever side channel leakage about the TCP stack on any contemporary operating system. And that is, if you, for example, in Windows, you open a console window and type netstat, you get an enumeration of all the system-wide TCP connections. And as of, I think, XP and on, you can add a command line switch that will tell you which processes are involved with those connections. So you can see that IE has the following connections open here and TweetDeck has them open there and so forth. Well, and in fact, there's one other thing. There's netstat-s, which shows you an array of counters which all Internet operating systems, starting with Unix and since, have maintained. These are things like the total number of packets sent, the total number of packets received, an array of error information, which is also available. Now, Linux has the same thing, which it implements differently. There's something called the proc file system, PROCFS. And it's sort of a clever way. It's not actually a file system of data that exists in any storage media. It's just a nice, clean way for the operating system to publish real-time information about things going on with it. And, for example, there's a path /proc/net/snmp, which stands for Simple Network Management Protocol, and then insegs, INSEGS, returns a count of the total number of TCP packets received. The same thing, proc netstat:inerrs, E-R-R-S, is a count of the erroneous packets received, like packets that have been received with a broken checksum, where the checksum doesn't match. And there's one called PA, also under NetStat, PAWSESTAB, PAWSESTAB. That's a count of old timestamp packets. PAWS, PAWS, is an acronym for Protect Against Wrapped Sequences. And that's exactly what I was talking about, the concern of sequences wrapping. The designers decided that they needed more than 32 bits, and they realized that the timestamp was a feature just never really took off and got used, so they could use that as a upward compatible means of providing some disambiguation. But it generates, it increments this count in the operating system if a timestamp is received, if a packet is received with a bad timestamp. The point of all this is that these guys in Michigan realized that if they had some software running in an Android phone, it could detect by using this common globally available information. This is an unprivileged read. It's everybody, all apps in Linux have access to the proc file system. It's readable. Everybody can have it. So what this provides is a so-called side channel attack. In we've talked about those in various contexts before, but never in this context, where something leaks information that can be used. For example, classic crypto has side channel attacks if it takes differing lengths of time to respond to, like, an encryption operation or a decryption operation, depending upon the data or the key. Because if you then use precise timing measurements, you know, you somehow induce a system to try to decrypt what you're giving it with an unknown key, and you look at the time it takes, if its time varies with the key, then it's leaking information in the time domain, which is, you know, at the perfect side channel example. It's not saying, you know, it's not giving you your data back properly, but it is leaking information that it didn't intend to. One of the reasons that AES was adopted was it is inherently power and time stable. It does not allow those kinds of side channel attacks, which is one, in fact, I don't think any of the submissions do or allow that, because it's now well understood that you just can't have crypto do that. What has not until now been understood is that doing something as benign as allowing an app to look at counters from the system-wide TCP stack is all it takes to launch exploits against other applications on the same OS. And that's what these guys have showed. So what they did is they have this piece of malware installed in an Android phone. You know, three different phones, two different versions of Android from HTC, Samsung, and Motorola. So it's widespread. They used an undisclosed nationwide cellular carrier. Their report doesn't want to point fingers at anybody. And it's not just one carrier that is doing this. They all do. I do know that it was a GPRS-based technology, because they referred to GPRS at one point in the some data files at one point in their report. So they have an attacking server located somewhere else that this malware is communicating with. And understand, in a real-world scenario, users would innocently think they had downloaded, you know, a Android version of Fire Sheep, or of, you know, how many calories have I eaten today app, or something that looks like it's, you know, absolutely benign. In fact, it never breaks out of the technical sandbox, but it establishes a connection to a malicious server, and then it waits. It waits for some activity on the phone that it wants to intercept. It might be instant messaging. It might be Twitter. It might be web browsing, you know, whatever it's designed to do. It's able to look at the processes running, and it's also able, from NetStat, to look at the processes that are communicating. And it knows, because NetStat shows it, both of the endpoints. It knows the local IP and port and the remote IP and port. What it doesn't know is the sequence numbering for that connection. So as soon as it sees a connection coming up, it communicates with a server located remotely that it's time to get busy and try to get into this connection. So the initial sequence packet opening a connection goes from the phone toward the true destination. Well, you know, say Google, just to pick an example. And the attacking server now sends a flood of probes back into the network aimed at the client. Between this attacking server and the client is this firewall, which is intending to do the right thing. It's going to block packets that don't have matching sequence numbers. Whose sequence numbers are unexpected. There's a window which moves along, that moves forward, of sequence numbers that will be accepted, and anything outside the window are rejected. So the idea is this thing, the attacking server, floods the connection back toward the client with guesses. And they've even figured out how to binary search the entire four gigabit, the 32-bit sequence number. They figured out how they can do a binary search in order to narrow it down. So the client is, what the client is doing, it cannot see that the malware running on the phone cannot see the traffic coming back. But the malicious server is deliberately generating packets using the time stamping option, which it knows are going to fail. So this one counter in the TCP stack, the PAW SE stab, which is the count of old timestamp packets received, it's normally not used. That counter normally sits at zero. So the point is, it's not noisy. They're not having to disambiguate other reasons for it to be incremented than their own. So what they've essentially done is they've managed to come up with a communications path through the side channel off the TCP stack that allows the malicious client in the phone to notify the server when its packets get through the firewall. That tells it then, that allows it to zero in on the sequence numbering of the connection and then verify that it knows where the connection sequence numbers are. Then it's able to respond as the original server was. It sends a reset packet to the original destination server, which resets the connection. The reset packet just causes, for example, in this case, it would be Google, causes Google to ignore the connection. And reset packets are honored by all servers. And Google doesn't know why the user changed his mind about connecting to it, doesn't care, just simply drops the connection completely. So Google no longer has any interest in the connection. In order for the reset packet to be accepted, it has to fit within this window. It has to be a valid sequence numbered reset packet, but the attacking server has been able to determine what that is through this probe. So Google has dropped off the connection. Now the attacker is able to send data in lieu of what Google would send as the response to whatever query the user initiated. Now, this is tricky because Remember that the traffic is not going to the bad guy. The traffic is going to Google's IP, and it's always going to go there. The traffic will continue going there, but Google's own firewalls or its operating systems will simply drop the traffic. That connection's been reset, so the traffic coming in is not part of a known connection, and it gets ignored. So the acknowledgments from the original client application running on the mobile phone are ignored. But when you think about it, there's nothing in TCP that actually requires that both ends receive the data that the other one is sending. That is, the malicious guy has a valid sequence number for the data going to the client on the mobile phone. He can assume the data gets there. He can assume packet after packet after packet are being acknowledged. The acknowledgments he never sees, they go to Google and they're ignored because the connection has been reset. They're just dropped. So we now have a situation where an app on a mobile phone initiated a TCP connection to some service, Facebook, Twitter, Google, whatever, or maybe has a long-standing connection open if the malware wants to go in and inject things into existing connections. But in this scenario, they open a connection. As far as the app knows in the phone, everything's fine. It sends its SYN off to open the connection, and the next thing it gets is a valid SYN ACK with a sequence number, which it accepts because it's coming from the malicious server. And Google accepts the reset packet because the bad guy figured out what the sequence number was in that direction, because that was allowed to get through the blocking firewall in the middle. Now, the app running in the mobile phone receives data, but it could be an HTTP redirect, which bounces them to a clone website without them seeing it. And these researchers achieved that. They also achieved installing JavaScript, injecting JavaScript into the connection and causing the JavaScript to run in the context of your relationship with Google, which means if you were permanently logged into Google, then they're able to send all of the information that your browser would normally never share with anyone but Google to, you know, off in any direction that they want to. So that's the gist of this. It is complex. To me, as I'm reading this, I'm thinking, okay, well, you know, this doesn't sound like the kind of thing that everyone is going to everyone's going to get infected by, but it's perfect for targeted attacks. Or, you know, with time, this kind of attack could mature to the point where apps are offered on Android stores. People download them, and the malware starts up in the background and gets up to its mischief. Now, I guess I feel of two minds about this. I mean, all the details are in this 14-page report that allows somebody as good as these guys are, and there are a lot of smart hackers in the world, to duplicate this. That is, nothing is left unknown. And the reason I'm of two minds about it is that it's not clear how we solve this. I mean, I guess providing the side channel information from the TCP stack only to root-based apps might make sense, but who knows what you would break? Who knows what apps are actually using that information for some purpose? So that fundamentally changes the way all of our Unix and Unix-derived and also Windows systems function. So we have a new problem which has surfaced that, in the context of mobile phones, breaks the sandbox and allows malicious packets to get injected. Now, the one thing that stops this cold is HTTPS. Because there's no way, if an HTTPS connection is being established, there's no way for the bad guy to have a valid certificate that the browser is going to require and verify. So throughout their paper, these guys mentioned that, you know, they did find in a secure connection with somebody, I think it was either Facebook or Twitter, there were two connections that still were not running over SSL. But this, you know, one thing this says to us is that certainly in a mobile network scenario where we're assuming that the encryption that the mobile provider is sufficient, is HTTP and unencrypted connections really are not sufficient. We really need to use end-to-end authentication, and that alone gives TCP the additional layer of authentication and privacy that it needs. TCP by itself just doesn't do it. It wasn't designed to do it. It was designed to work, and it really works well, but it's not very attack resistant, unfortunately. Isn't that cool, Leo?
Reason why HTTPS everywhere is a good idea.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is, this is some seriously clever hacking and an interesting way of using a little bit of information leaking across the OS boundary, which is, you know, how many errors of a certain type have we seen, and then deliberately generating those kinds of errors on packets that may or may not get through a middleware firewall, and using that to probe the firewall, which in turn releases information about the state of the TCP connection that would otherwise never be available, and then you exploit that in order to hijack the TCP connection.
Wow. Wow. And is this in the wild, or is this just merely an academic exercise?
Academic exercise.
Okay, so we don't have to fear it.
There's nothing to fear.
Except that it's been documented now, and so...
Yes. There's also nothing to do, really. I would love to see Android lock this stuff down,
yeah.
And I would be surprised if they don't. I mean, everybody... I got so many tweets about this, people saying... Okay, I don't know what these guys said, Steve. Could you explain it to us?
What does it mean? Well, now we know what it means. I don't know if
it sounds bad. This looks bad.
I don't know if you feel any better, but now we know what it means anyway.
Yes.
So this show, as with all of the previous 354 episodes, lives in several places. You can, of course, watch us live every Wednesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC, right here on twit.tv. But if you missed a show or... I think more likely you wanted to listen again or even read a transcription. Steve makes text transcriptions available as well as 16 kilobit audio versions at his site, grc.com. We also have audio and video and higher quality versions at twit.tv. And you can get it on a podcaster like iTunes or Downcast or any of those as well. In fact, that's the best way. Subscribe to the version you like. That way you'll never miss an episode, and you'll own all 355 at absolutely no charge. Steve also makes a lot of other great things available at grc.com, including his bread and butter, SpinRite, world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. He also has a lot of freebies there, including the world-famous Shields Up, and lots of free security stuff, too. grc.com. Now, when you're there, if you have a question about this or anything in the realm of security, privacy, vitamin D, or fish oil, you can or ketogenic diets, you can leave those questions for us to talk about next week, because every other episode we do a feedback episode. grc.com/feedback. Did I miss anything there?
I should mention that I've had a bunch of really neat feedback from our two Over the Sugar Hill episodes over at grc.com/health. And there is a feedback page there for health-related stuff. Anybody who wants to share their experiences, I've got a user experiences page and an FAQ page that I will be updating shortly. So love to hear what people think.
My dad just sent me an email saying, you know, you got to be taking vitamin D. I said, been there, done that, know all about it. And I sent him a link to your health page. I said, we did a show about it. And, yeah, in fact, I've been talking to my doctor about the ketogenic diet. He's really interested in that art and science of low-carbohydrate living that that we're using as our Bible.
I forgot to say, I got email from Jeff Bond.
Whoa.
The author of Deadly Harvest.
Whoa.
Apparently, we spiked his sales, and he's now the number one rated preventative health book on Amazon.
The Power of the Gibson.
And and so he sent me a note saying, hey, thanks, Steve.
That's great.
You got a kick out of the fact that I wasn't that enamored with the name of the book. but I understood that it wouldn't sell as many copies if it was, titled Nutritional Anthropology that I have known. So anyway, it was neat to hear from Jeff. Yeah.
It's interesting, too, because we get people in studio all the time now who are on the ketogenic diet or have been doing it. A guy was here last week, lost 80 pounds, looked great.
Huh.
Another guy who had celiac disease, so he was compelled to because of his intolerance for wheat and glutens. And he also said, he looked great. He said, I've lost a lot of weight. Every day almost somebody comes in here and says, that's Steve. Well, it started with Paul Theriot, and now it's spread.
Yep. So. Well, and in fact, many people, they started with Paul. And in some cases, the carbs crept back in because it's just so difficult to.
It's hard.
There's so much.
Well, we're
it's
everywhere. We're inundated with it.
We're a carb based culture. But then they said when they heard, my two podcasts and a lot of the, the biochemistry of it, they understood. In fact, one person said that ketosis was the only way she'd ever been able to lose weight, but it always starved her to death. Now she knew how she could do
it. She knows why.
And not be hungry all the time and not have to starve. So, yeah.
Cool stuff. Great stuff. Thank you, Steve. GRC.com. It's all there. Is it GRC.com/health if people want to read more about that?
Yep. And okay. Also in the menu, if you go under research, there's health as a subtopic of the research tab.
A lot of stuff there. Thank you, Steve. We will do this next week right here.
Talk to you then, Leo.
See ya. Security now.